I would like to thank Margot and the University of Virginia for inviting me here. It is a great honor. I actually first met Margot here long time ago, maybe 15 years ago, something like that. Indeed, she was a graduate student at UVA, and when I was approached to say, how should one develop a collection of Aboriginal art by Kluge, I said the essential thing was really to have someone who knew about Australian Aboriginal Society to work. Was there anyone around? And John Kluge got somebody to look through the list of students, graduate students at the University of Virginia, and found there was a Margot Smith who happened to be working in Alice Springs in Central Australia. I said, I'm sure she'll do. When I arrived, there was Margot. And it really is a great tribute to her that this collection has developed and evolved over time. This is actually probably the premier research institution in the world for Australian Aboriginal art. It's hard to believe that, but if you're in Australia, you recognise that's the case, and you do elsewhere in the world. And so I do hope very much that the University of Virginia recognises the enormous importance that this collection has and the resources associated with it. Now, this lecture today, although at the moment we're not looking at art from Northern Australia, but rather Northern United States of America, actually from Canada in this case, I better modify the Northern United States of America. This lecture is going to be a fairly general one on portraiture, but you'll see it hones in centrally on Australian Aboriginal art as it develops. As an anthropologist, I'm interested in the cross-cultural, in what human cultures share in common as much as their differences. Indeed, I would argue that it's only once we understand what we share in common that we can appreciate the subtlety of our difference. The past 500 years of history following the European Renaissance, the Enlightenment, and the associated colonial expansion have tended to create a world in which certain European categories, concepts, and institutions have become globalized. An institution like a National Portrait Gallery, which we have in Canberra as well as in Washington and London, comes out of this process. It connects the idea of the nation with a view of the importance of individuals in building that nation, with a conception of art that is at least influenced by Kantian aesthetics, and with the idea of portraiture as a physical likeness verging on realism that is hard to dispel. Yet if we apply those criteria to literally to Australian Aboriginal art, the art of the Yolngu people I've been spending many years working with, we'd find a mismatch. And we might quite reasonably conclude that Yolngu don't have a concept of portraiture as it's generally understood. Yolngu do not have an equivalent concept of the nation state. They tend to downplay individual contributions. They don't have a Kantian conception of art and do not produce likenesses in the manner of European representational art. The genius of the excellence of the National Portrait Gallery in Canberra that was almost forced on them by the fact that Indigenous Australia has got to be incorporated in the nation state is that it recognised from the start that Australian Aboriginal art had to be in the portrait gallery. And many of the images that you'll see later on are ones that were in their opening exhibition. The Australian National Portrait Gallery has also been aided in extending the base by the fact that portrait has become problematized in Western art practice. And I can begin here with a citation from Mark Rothko. "The modern artist has in varying degrees detached himself from appearance in nature. Today, the artist is no longer constrained by the limitation that all of man's experience is expressed in his outward appearance. Freed from the need of describing a particular person, the possibilities are endless. The whole of man's experience becomes his model. And in that sense, it can be said that all art is the portrait of an idea." Now, Sayers rightly argues that Rothko is stretching the point perhaps a little too far. In describing the particular person, artists have always been involved in social and communicative processes. In describing a person, we're describing both an individual and a social being. The portrait has never been a simple reproduction of a person's outward appearance, if such a thing were possible, but has always been concerned with the physical and with the biographical attributes, such as their profession, accomplishments, and so on. Even if the idea of portraiture were reduced to the likeness of a person, factors of scale, posture, demeanor, expression, and so on come into play. The attributes of a person are framed by history and culture, and the nature of the portrait will vary according to the artistic practice and conventions of the time. Now, I approach art as a form of action in the world, and hence, rather than looking for portraits in Yolngu art, I'll focus on portraiture as a process that enables individuals to be present or represented through art. Portraiture concerns the relationship between art and the human person. In developing cross-cultural categories, my practice as an anthropologist is to adopt an approach that has something in common with the Wittgensteinian idea of family resemblance. Rather than employing restricted and exclusive definition, I look for attributes that a portrait may have that it shares in common with forms of art in other cultures. Under my definition, portraits that show a physical likeness to the person, portraits that create the illusion of the actual presence of the person, are one subcategory of portrait. And that form of portraiture itself does occur across space and time. The Romans are renowned for their portrait sculptures, and so are the Native Americans of the Northwest Coast. And I'm beginning by showing two portrait masks produced by the Haida artist Simeon Stilta in the 1870s. The masks were made for the winter ceremonial when the recently dead were commemorated and in effect brought back in elaborate masquerades, where on some occasions the circumstances of their deaths were reenacted. The mask of a dead youth, which is this portrait here, almost brings tears to my eyes. And the second mask was worn in a ceremony by Haida dancers to represent members of a different linguistic group in the reenactment of an exchange ceremony. However, what I want you to note in this case is that the face is painted with a clan design that represents the person's lineage and spiritual identity. Hence, in a single image, we have two distinct portraits that interact: a relatively realistic image of the dancer's face and the geometric design that marks his clan. And yet, of course, it can be argued that the physiognomy of the face and the form of the design represent the one person. So Northwest Coast masks, portrait masks, are characterized by this extraordinary sense of realism. And there we have the clan design that, of course, is part of the realistic representation of the person, because if you see the person in a dance, they're going to be wearing that particular kind of body design. And masks like this were indeed used in extraordinary theatrical performances that recreated episodes in a person's life, and the person would appear in different places in the ceremonial house. In the discussion so far, I've emphasized what I will define as two components of portraiture: a sense of the presence of a person, and attributions of a person's biography and identity. Now, both are present in the Haida case. In the next part of this lecture, I'll apply these distinctions to three other portraits before returning to the Yolngu. The portraits in question are two paintings, one by a Scottish artist and the other an Australian artist, and an extract from a novel by Henry James. This is a conversation piece by the Scottish artist Stanley Cursiter, painted in 1925 and entitled The Grey Room. The painting seems to evoke those two senses of a conversation piece: paintings of a set of people as if they were conversing, and a painting that becomes a topic of conversation. Stanley Cursiter had a major reputation as a portrait painter in the conventional sense, and indeed he became the Royal Limner to Scotland, the Queen's official portrait painter. whose duties included drawing pictures of our person and of our successors or others of our royal family for the decorment of our houses and palaces. In the painting set in an Edinburgh New Town drawing room, two women appear to be looking at us out of the frame. However, if we look further behind them is a mirror, and they're in fact looking at two men deep in conversation on the other side of the room. And behind them, too, is a mirror reflecting back into the room. The women are portrayed in quite contrasting manner. The woman on the left in the white dress is focused intensely on the two men. The seated woman has shaded her face with her hand and seems to be looking into the distance, a little sadly and withdrawn into herself. I feel strongly the presence of the two women and can interpret the scene in a number of ways. By presence, I mean that the painting conveys something of their emotional life or how they felt. I think I could step into the painting. I feel a certain sadness that the people are no longer with us when they seem so alive. Now, my sense of their presence, however, is so far disconnected from their biographies. If I knew who they were, I would gain some more information about them from the furnishings in the room and their attire. And in fact, I do know who they are, or at least who three of them are. The woman on the left is Poppy Lowe. Sitting beside her is Phyllis Cursiter, once a violinist in the Glasgow Chamber Orchestra, married to Stanley Cursiter, the artist, who is the man standing on the left in animated conversation there. But we don't know with whom. But from Cursiter's other paintings, it's likely to be a friend and fellow Orcadian, possibly Eric Linklater. Cursiter at the time of the painting was earning his living as an artist, and he subsequently became director of the National Gallery of Scotland. I could fill out the biographical details of the painting in great detail. I know the house in Edinburgh New Town where it was painted. I even know where the glass bowl on the table now resides. And I know all this because the painting is a family portrait, and Frances Morphy, my wife, is the artist's granddaughter. But I can tell you very little more about Poppy Lowe. She was painted many times by Stanley Cursiter and by other Scottish artists, Scottish colourists, including Peplow. But she's only ever referred to as the model Poppy Lowe, as if her identity was irrelevant to the painting. So, to me, Poppy Lowe has presence, but no biography outside the paintings in which she appears. Another painting that started thinking in this direction. A little bit different. One that is included in the opening exhibition of the National Portrait Gallery in Canberra. It's a painting by Tony Tuckson. It was completed in 1970, and it's entitled Wind. In most cases, Tuckson provided very little guidance to the interpretation of his abstract expressionist works. They're usually called sort of number one, number two, or white, red, and yellow, and black, or something like this. This was an exception, and Daniel Thomas, a well-known Australian curator, art historian, gallery director, recalls Tuckson saying it had something to do with the sight of Renée Free running with her hair streaming. And Andrew Sayers in the description of this said, knowing that affects the way we look at the painting. It becomes, in its way, a portrait. We cannot help seeing it as having a human presence. One source of energy in the painting is the wind. Another is the presence of a person. However, I've shortened Andrew's quote because after mentioning René Free's name, he thought it necessary to add a biographical note in parentheses. A curatorial colleague at the Art Gallery of New South Wales, where Tuckson was deputy director. Presence and biography are two relatively autonomous components of a portrait. They may work together, or they may be largely separate. In viewing Tuckson's painting, I can sense the presence of Renée Free, but I do not see in it her biography. It could be argued that a presence is always particular, the presence of someone. If instead of wind, Tuckson's painting were retitled Renée Free, then if I met her, I would have already imagined something about her. But it's the caption that gives particularity to the presence in this case. And from the caption, we can build up certain relationships. Through Tutson's eye, I can see René Free running across the road outside the Art Gallery of New South Wales in the late 1960s, her hair caught in a sudden gust of wind. But that context is not in the painting. Only her presence is. To me, it wouldn't matter if it had been another woman's hair that had inspired Tutson. Indeed, in my mind's eye, his painting can evoke the presence of quite different women of my own experience, whose long hair I can imagine flying in the wind. Just as I would have felt the powerful presence of the women in Cursiter's painting, even if I did not know who they were. In thinking of portraiture, I think it's helpful to distinguish between presence and biography. Biography can be built into portraiture in innumerable ways, apart from by attribution. The most conventional way is to clothe the person with reference to his or her status, to portray them taking part in, it's coming from outside, a significant event in their lives, or to paint them in their surroundings. It is possible to imagine biographical portraits in which presence is almost absent. Portraits of members of the judiciary in formal attire can almost vanish the person in favour of the office. And the genius of Ralph Hayman's portrait of Justice Kirby is partly because of the way in which the artist plays with these conventions. In the end, it is Justice Kirby who loses part of his attire. However, it's equally possible to imagine a powerful presence from the material world that surrounds them, even if they're absent themselves. It's possible to imagine presence when the physical body is absent altogether. Now, Henry James used this technique to give the reader of an idea of the character of a person before they enter the text. For example, in The Bostonians, a Southern visits his cousin in Boston. The young man, left alone, looked about the parlor, the two parlors, which in their adjacent narrowness formed evidently one apartment. It seemed to him he had never seen an interior that was so much of an interior as this queer corridor-shaped room of his newfound kinswoman. He'd never felt himself in the middle of so much organized privacy or of so many objects that spoke of habits and tastes. He'd always heard of Boston as a city of culture, and now there was culture in Miss Chancellor's tables and sofas, in the books that were everywhere, on the little shelves like brackets, as if a book were a statuette, in the photographs and watercolours that covered the walls. He also concluded that he would never be tempted to make love to the owner of the parlour. But then recall, he had such different tastes. His concept of material comfort was not very definite. It consisted mainly of the vision of plenty of cigars and brandy and water with newspapers and a cane-bottomed armchair of the right inclination from which he could stretch his legs. I hope that these very different examples I've looked at so far have shown the salience of the concepts of presence and biography to cross-cultural discourse on portraiture. The expression of these elements are quite independent of the mode of representation. We can find them in art forms that vary from abstract expressionism through conventional Western portraiture in the style of Cursiter to the portrait masks of the Northwest Coast and the descriptive writing of Henry James. And this provides us with a perspective for looking at portraiture in Yolngu art. Now, traditionally, Yolngu did not produce portrait likenesses of people. Indeed, on the surface, the human form seems absent from Yolngu representations. Human figures are rare in paintings, and the human face rarer still. The immediate question to ask is, where do we find portraiture in Yolngu society when the face of a person is largely absent? Now, in fact, in the images I'm showing, I'm obviously selecting ones where you will see much more human face than you do in most Yolngu paintings. The immediate question, and here I'll begin by considering two attributes of a portrait that I singled out earlier, biography and presence. Before doing so, however, we need to a little account of Yolngu ontology. And we can look at a Yolngu painting while we do that. Art is part of the process of connecting Yolngu people to the ancestral dimension, to the Wangar. You only see the presence and future as stemming from the Wangar. The Wangar beings created the form of the world in the ancestral past through their actions. They gave birth to the original human beings, and they set the order of the world. The ancestral beings, in a sense, left behind them a world of representations, or a body of evidence that makes them visible in the present. In the Yolngu case, it's quite reasonable to speak of representation, since Yolngu see much of the evidence they inherit from the ancestral past as representations, designs that are passed on from generation to generation. They're believed in many cases to be the designs that were first produced by the ancestral beings to commemorate events in their lives, painted on their bodies, woven into objects that they created. However, as ancestral representations, they're also considered to be evidence of the thought of the ancestral beings, and they're endowed with sacred power. The ancestral beings, however, are not remote from the living. They're present in the world, and they're also linked directly to human beings. Ancestral beings have presence and a biography. Their presence is everywhere, in the form of the landscape, in the power of the currents, in the force of the wind, in the smells and sounds of nature. Theirs is a living biography that can be experienced as one walks through the landscape. Now, this image shows a bark painting by Narichin Maimaru of the ancestral woman Nyapililngu, placed in the landscape she created. Nyapililngu made the sand dunes that you can see behind the painting by spinning great mounds of possum first dream. She inhabited the dunes, walking up and down with the aid of her digging sticks. Her digging sticks on either side that she's holding. And there's a carrying basket on her head that she used to collect wild plums and fish. When her brother was lost at sea, she stood on top of the dunes, scanning the horizon. And when his dead body was washed up on the shore, she cut her head deeply in mourning. And the blood flowed, creating the lake that exists today beneath the dunes. She remains a living presence in the landscape. Her images are everywhere, in the fragile weeping forms of the casuarina trees that line the shores, in the salty taste of the lake's water, in the places where no one is allowed to go. And people should always be wary of her presence, lest they offend her by some inadvertent act. But in times of grief, she's there to help return life to normal. And there is the lake that Nyapililngu created. That's the place that I took that photograph from. Those are the high dunes. Those are the dunes that she stood on looking out to sea. That's where her dead brother's body came ashore. Here's where she cut her head in mourning, and the lake there is produced by the blood that poured from the wound into the lake there. The ancestral dimension is also a life that one can participate in through ceremony. Ceremonies are comprised of the songs, dances, paintings, sacred objects that not only represent the ancestral beings, but also are derived from them and embody them. A successful ceremonial performance, like a successful portrait, evokes the presence of the ancestral beings. In a very real sense, these manifestations of the Wangar are their portraits. Now let us follow briefly the biography of one of the main sense of ancestral beings, the Jankau sisters. Now you'll find a lot of paintings of the Jankau sisters in the Kluge Roo collection, and several of them by the artist of this painting, a man called Maolan Marika. This is not a bark painting. This is a crayon drawing done on butcher's paper in 1946, really only 10 years after the first European presence in Northeast Arnhem Land, with the establishment of the mission station at Yirrkala in 1935. And Ron Burnt, as an anthropologist, went up there in 1946, and bark is seasonal. You can paint bark paintings only for about 4 months of the year, at the end of the wet season, when the bark comes off the trees, when the sap is flowing. So he actually asked his father, who was a emigre jeweler in Adelaide, to send him up rolls and rolls of brown butcher's paper and crayons. And he got people to do this extraordinary set of drawings that represent different aspects of Yolngu life. Many of the drawings look very like bark paintings, but others of them incorporated a whole series of smaller paintings from separate places on the journey. It's a kind of palimpsest of different works. Okay, two women who set off from a place called Buralco, the island of the Morning Star, and went to Yallingborough on the east coast of Arnhem Land. Now, this is Buralco. This is the two women. That's their canoe. This is a journey where they're following the light of the Morning Star across the sea from this mythical island of Buralco towards the coast of Northeast Arnhem Land to this place called Yallingborough. Yallingborough is seen from the shore as these enormous piled high dunes. And as they got close to the shore, they would hear the sound of ducks. They would hear the sound of parakeets in a tree. They would then see flying foxes. They would hear the sound of the tide running slowly up and down the beach. And each of these places that they saw in their imagination, they actually were carrying sacred objects in the boats that represented those places. And these more geometrical images that you see here are the paintings that represent those places that they heard and that they eventually visited. And when they got there, they performed a major creative acts. And those major creative acts, in simple terms, are that they needed water. So they used their digging sticks to dig a well. That well became a water hole. They then put the digging sticks in the ground beside the well. Those digging sticks grew into beautiful trees. They wove dilly bags, beautiful sacred bags, put them and hang them in the trees. They then observed all of the plants and animals in the neighborhood, gave them names, and then they gave birth to the people in the place. They gave birth to the people by using their digging sticks to open the passageway for the children to come flooding out into the mats that they had to cover themselves for modesty, and the mats that they had beside the waterhole. So this is a long, complicated myth that we're going to show how they represent them in the next series of images. So their biography then involved this long journey from Buralco to Yallingborough. And in the bottom right of the painting, from where you're looking, the Jianghao can be seen setting off from Buralco. They followed the Morning Star as it lights their journey across the sea. They encounter sea creatures. They landed first at Yallingborough, where the high sand dunes separated the land from the sea. Their boat was transferred into a rocky island offshore. Once they landed, they changed the world. They dug wells. The wells were transformed into water holes. Digging sticks became trees. They set off across country and created features of the landscape in different places, marked their way. And Mao Lung's drawing can be seen as this palimpsest of images that belong to different places on the way. Each one of them can occur separately as a body painting, in a funeral, in a circumcision ceremony, in a men's initiation ceremony. And finally, then they gave birth. They gave birth beside the sacred well that they had created, under conical mats. And this next painting is also by Mao Lung. This painting represents this event. This painting is in the Art Gallery of New South Wales. This painting is connected very closely to Tony Tuckson's abstract expressionist painting of René Free. It was done almost at the same time, and Tony Tuckson collected this painting. And when he was the director, deputy director of the Art Gallery of New South Wales, he was the first gallery, art gallery person to build major collections of Aboriginal art and house them in the gallery. And it was another nearly 30 years before any other gallery showed that kind of interest in Aboriginal art. So this magnificent painting here is one of the series that he produced. The painting is an extraordinary celebration of life, with the abundant children flowing from the ancestral womb. And I'll now show a series of close-ups of this. Now, it's important to note that the birth is represented in two different modes of representation, a figurative mode and a geometric mode. Meaning in Yolngu art is conveyed by the interrelationship between the figurative and geometric elements of paintings, enhanced by their expressive qualities. Now, the upper panel, which is what we're looking at now, shows the women giving birth in a very literal manner to the generations of clanspeople of the two moieties. The birth scene is replicated in a lower panel in a more schematic way. And we'll go and look at that next panel. Okay, so here are the two ancestral women. Here they're giving birth. Now, there are multiple interpretations of these elements that you can see here. So the circle actually represents the water hole in a particular sense. It represents the mats, the conical mats that they covered their bodies with. Those two are actually conical mats. It represents water lily leaves that were covering the surface of the water hole. In this particular case, the white dotted pattern refers either to the afterbirth blood of giving birth to all these enormous clans of children that then again becomes part of the water of the wells, or it can actually represent the spirit children themselves going out into the landscape. So we have a multiplicity of meanings here. Now, if you got rid of the women, you would actually have something closer to the way that Yolngu represent that on body paintings. So you can see here the way in which a whole series of meanings are getting condensed in this painting. Get rid of the figures, then people would find it very difficult to say what this painting was about. And I would have to do a long explanation to let you know that it was actually about the giving birth of women in the context of a waterhole that used the Ngai Mara mat, that the women had invented, made the waterholes themselves, and so on and so forth. So there is an enormous density of meanings in this painting that you know because you've looked at this painting here, and I know because I've looked at this painting here. Now, believe it or not, the story of them giving birth is represented also in this section of this painting here. So let's have a look at that section in close-up. Here we are. Here, two water holes, two ancestral women giving birth, or two sacred mats, or the morning star that they were following with its beams of light going across the water, or the sun which heated them up during the day as they shaded under the tree. So you can actually see all of the meanings are condensed in that more geometric painting. And if we move on here, you'll actually suddenly start to see the structural relationship in Yolngu terms. When Yolngu look at a painting like this here, they actually see this as part of the meanings that are encoded in them. And structurally, this image here has, of course, great analogues with the structure of this painting here. That structure, though, is masked. This is one woman, one side of the waterhole, other woman, other side of waterhole, giving birth, both women having Ngai Mara or ceremonial mats. Even here, the water lily represented almost in figurative terms, but actually extending out of the vulvas of that particular ancestral woman there. So what you have is this incredible process of condensation of meaning in Yolngu art. And I'll just summarize what I've said here. The birth scene is replicated in the lower panel in a more schematic way, with children and afterbirth blood flowing into the waters of the well covered with lily leaves. The painting also includes four circles, which have multiple reference. Let's actually go back to the one that I'm talking about. Or can have, in other contexts, representing the wells itself. The design represents the place where the women gave birth, and the circle in the center has, in this image here, those multiple interpretations. So I've just summarized there what I actually showed you. I've hinted already that the ancestral beings, in addition to having their own biography and their own portraits in the landscape, are part of the continuing biography of the human beings who they left behind, the human beings who they created. Life is a process of separation from and reincorporation within the ancestral dimension. People come from the Wanga, lead a life that is in many respects an individual journey, and then become again reincorporated within the ancestral dimension. The beginning of life is through spirit conception. During the course of a person's life, spiritual identity is reinforced, and on death, the person's reabsorbed in the ancestral dimension. So that place that was the well that woman Nyapililngu bled into actually is the source of conception spirits for the clans associated with that country. And it's the place where the spirits of the dead are directed to. The next image is from the beginning of life and is also autobiographical. Jungi believed that life is initiated in the mother's womb by a conception spirit. The conception spirit is an incarnation of one of the clan's ancestral beings and is usually associated with an important named place. This is Mungurawi Yunupingu's crayon drawing of his own spirit conception. This is an extraordinarily complex composition that illustrates the multiple spatio-temporal perspectives that Yolngu include within their art. And here I can only document it briefly and draw attention to its composite character. The top section of the painting is based on a Yiricha Moiety clan design associated with the artist's mother, the kind of design that would occur as a body painting. And the design refers to mangrove worms that eat their way through the body of a decaying mangrove tree that is actually the body of an ancestral being that walks the country, that creates places. The sinuous line along the bottom represents an ancestral track following the line of a river with mangrove trees on either side. And beneath the tree line creek is a line of anvil-shaped designs that represent the oncoming clouds of the wet season as they move towards the Arnhem Land coast to fill up the streams. Mungurawi's conception place is close to his father's footprints that are shown beside the river. The painting is constructed, as I say, as a series of palimpsests, with the upper section in effect being an enlargement of the section of the riverbank where the conception spirit entered his mother. So this is really an amazing painting. You can see here, these are the footprints. This is a river. These are the wet season clouds. The mangrove trees here were created by a mangrove tree ancestral being. This painting here is a representation of that ancestral sacred tree down there. And this place on the river is his conception place, and at the beginning of the wet season was the time of his conception. So his father, in producing this painting of his conception, has actually painted a biography of the very beginning of his life and the time that it occurred and the spiritual processes connected with it. Okay. As people go through life, the relationship between themselves and the ancestral dimension is continually reinforced. This is partly because an individual's ancestral identity and personal identity are intertwined through kinship. People have responsibilities and rights that derive from their ancestral identity. It influences the ways they participate in ceremonies, but it also, people are named after the ancestral beings. They marry according to the pattern established by the ancestral beings, and when nearing death, they prepare themselves to become part of that ancestral dimension. At different stages in a person's life, their ancestral identity is reinforced by the role they take in ceremony, by the sacred objects they see, and by the paintings that are painted on their bodies. So this image shows a boy having been painted at a circumcision ceremony at Yilpra on Blue Mud Bay. The Jankow sisters, and this is a painting associated with the Jankow sisters, had travelled there on another part of their journey. And the painting refers to a place where they hung their sacred dilly bags in a tree and where they watched Goanna's play in a waterhole that they had created. The design adds an ancestral skin to the body. They make the person, in Bill Stanner's terms, consubstantial with the ancestors. The main medium for paintings were the body and sheets of bark, and the same word, barwan, is applied to both. Paintings are painted on skin. And in form, many bark paintings, in particular early on, followed the frame of the body, with an extension of the paintings to cover the thighs and across the shoulders. Paintings were almost hung on the body, and when separated from the body, often took its form. So painting here by an artist called Mundakul, who would have died in the 1950s, collected by the anthropologist Donald Thompson before the establishment of the mission. And you can see there is the body painting on the chest and stomach all the way down. There is the painting that would be painted on the top of the legs. And there are the designs that would be painted around the shoulders. They almost look, from our viewpoint, kind of straps that you hang a painting on, but of course the only didn't have sweatshirts or t-shirts and things like that. And this painting represents an ancestral fish trap made out of an ancestral snake. There's the form of a snake. These represents the ribs of the snake. The snake created this fish trap out of the ribs taken out of his body, and subsequently Yolngu used this particular form of making snakes, replacing mangrove wood to the snake's ribs. Now, it could be argued that Now, the next illustration shows a boy with his face painted in a design associated with the Wawelak sisters. The face painting is one that they wore when they were hunting through the forests for wild honey. However, the point I'd like to make here is that the design itself on the face is integral to the person's identity and becomes a representation of that person in precisely the same way that the crest is integral to the identity of a person in a Haida portrait mask. So here we have the Haida portrait mask. Here we have a Yolngu face painting. And here we have the clan design on the face. And here we have the clan design on this particular mask. So you can see both how realistic the Haida painting, portrait painting, is going to be, given that people will be painted themselves with those kind of face paintings. But you can also see the sense in which Yolngu see this as an additional ancestral skin or portrait that is put onto their bodies. It could be argued that a person's individuality is lost in this process, that the person is subordinate to the grand ancestral design. And to an extent, this is true, but equally, it is the living human beings, their presence in people's memories, and the particularities of their lives that feeds into the ancestral dimension. Although in Yolngu terms people follow the way of the ancestors, in some ways the reverse is true and acknowledged by Yolngu. Unless they continue to summon the ancestors will die. Paintings become the memories of people who are associated with them in life, people who are named after them, people whose spirit came from them. Memories of the recent dead give power to the paintings that they represent. The face painting we've just seen was painted during a Junguan ceremony at Trial Bay, filmed by Ian Dunlop. This ceremony is an initiation ceremony for young men and often the context of their circumcision. But it's also a memorial ceremony for the generation that's passed away. Just as the ancestral being is part of the biography of a person, the ancestral being gains strength from the people who are remembered through them. The focal point of the Junguan ceremony are Juen posts. Now, I can't go into this in any detail, but this is on the final day of the ceremony. the boy who we saw had his face painted, and he will eventually lie down in this ceremonial ground, and a feather string will be shaken above his head, and feathers will fall onto his body, and so on. He is representing, and the body face painting, the ancestral beings who created this country. And the ancestral beings were two female ancestral beings, the Wawelak sisters, who traveled, lived rather like men, speared kangaroos, cut down trees with axes. And here are female relatives of the boy acting the ancestral Wawelak sisters as they dance towards the ceremonial ground. And these posts here, there we can see one, we'll see a close-up in a minute, are representations of the ancestral beings whose face painting the boy is wearing. So in this ceremony, there's a very strong connection drawn between his relatives, the ancestral beings, the place, the face painting, but also to the person's grandmother. Because the person's grandmother died some, in this case, 8 years previously, and she came from the same spirit home as he is being linked to. And this painting here is that post that we saw. And here, these beautiful feather bags have been hung up by the women as the ancestral women hung those bags in the ancestral past. And here we can see the Duain post, the ceremonial post, in the Child Bay in Gokuloi. And that painting there represents the spirit place to which his grandmother has returned. So you can see here that the biography of the ancestral women reenacted actually links in with the person's own biography and history and gives meaning to both. Now, in conclusion, I'd like to return to Maolung's great painting of the Jiankao giving birth. It's a religious painting. And like all great religious paintings, it has many dimensions to it. It's a narrative painting and a work of religious pedagogy. It was painted to show one of the great events of the Jiankao sisters' creative lives, and the events occurred in place. It contains powerful expressive images, both figurative and abstract. The hyperfertility of the women as creative beings, the shimmering effect of the crosshatching. The painting is one of the ways in which the presence of the Jiankao can be felt. So as a portrait, it fits in the category of religious portraiture more generally. And I'm tempted to draw an analogy with portraits of saints in Christianity. Certainly, the Methodist missionaries who were in dialogue with the Yolngu would have been making that analogy in a positive appreciation of Yolngu religious iconography. But as well as being portraits of the Jiankao, the images are self-referential as far as the artist is concerned. It represents the artist reflecting on himself. The panel on the upper right shows Maolung himself looking at one of those ceremonial digging sticks of the Jiankao sisters. And indeed that digging stick, there we are, there's the digging stick, there's Maolung, shares his name, Maolung. And in looking at that digging stick, Maolung would have seen a sacred form that he himself would have made and used in ritual. And the digging stick is one that Maolung would have used to evoke the presence of the Jiankao, making them alive through ritual action. Now, Peter Funnell, consultant editor for Likenesses for the British Dictionary of Biography, says that from medieval times onwards, authors of manuscripts often included an image in the text to represent themselves as author. Funnell and his associate research editor, Henry Summerson, acknowledged the fact that from the 4th to the 14th century, realistic portraiture was virtually unknown in Britain. Portraits of the authors in manuscripts were not individual likenesses, but conventional representations that resembled each other more than they resembled their subject. However, one of the things we learn from a cross-cultural study of art is that images that at first seem to be standardized and stereotyped and distant from the individual, in context, gain a particularity. It is not difficult to see in Maolung's schema the presence of the artist. The painting provides important elements of his personal and ancestral biography, and the schematic image conveys the disposition of the artist in a state of contemplation. And as a final word, I'd like to return to Mark Rothko's enigmatic statement that all art is portrait of an idea, and reverse it a little. What can be a portrait depends on one's idea of a portrait. And depending on one's idea of a portrait, then almost anything can be a portrait. I argue that two components of portraiture that have resonance cross-culturally are presence and biography. And so my penultimate image has both of these, but like many portraits, it needs a caption. It's actually my ultimate image. The sculptures are by Mawalung and Mungarawi. They represent, respectively, one of the Jankau sisters and Langchung. That's one of the Jankau sisters here, and that's Langchung. That's by Mungarawi, that's by Mawalung. The sculptures were given to Tony Tuckson by the artists on their departure from Yirrkala in 1959. From the Yolngu perspective, they were a gift to thank the Tuxens and Scougals for their engagement with Yolngu art and commissioning the artworks for the Art Gallery of New South Wales. They were to remind them of the time spent together. They were portraits of ancestral beings, but also of a relationship that has been established. Looking at this carving, Margaret sees the artists Mawalung and Mungarawi as if they were present, as if there was an accompanying photograph. And that, too, synergizes with the way Yolngu look at photographs. Yolngu classify photographs of the dead as murdayan, as sacred, as being in the same category as body paintings or the feather tassels that hang down from sacred objects. So Yolngu, looking at this and looking at a photograph, would place it in the same category. I'll finish at that point, but any questions? I don't know if we have time for the others. Oh, a question. I mean, the easy way to answer that is simply to go back to this and this. These were paintings that were done 2 years ago at a Yolngu circumcision ceremony. There would be very difficult to discern a difference between a painting like that that was done today and a painting or a photograph that Donald Thompson took. So as far as those particular images are concerned, there is enormous continuity. And what I argue in the case of Yolngu art is that there is an element of recursivity in the whole process of their painting. They have an incredibly rich and diverse artistic tradition, and their body of practice is to look, in a sense, back into that as a sort of archive of visual images that they can bring up in different contexts over time. And in the case of a sacred painting, it may only be used, a particular one like that, every 5 or 6 years. So in a sense, they've got this enormous inventory of painting. And what happens in the context of paintings that will be made for outsiders, and made for outsiders will either be made for sale or today, I mean, Yolngu in painting their schools and public buildings and things like this will use their own art as that form of sort of communication that's both for themselves and the outside world. Then they will incorporate figurative elements that look different from figurative elements that they've done before. They will actually do something with the geometric art. I haven't got any illustrations here, but there are many, and Margot has some in Maklugi Roo, that will transform those in some ways, often by actually making the geometric elements more asymmetrical, move in particular ways and directions and things like that. And you think, gosh, you know, they're doing something completely different, completely new that's never been done before. And then you'll suddenly look at a painting in Donald Thompson's and, gosh, there's that particular way of doing that there. So it's a very, very schooled, artistic, practice that has a trajectory, that is very dynamic, that can produce paintings you've never seen before in your life, but it's also got this recursive thing that it goes back to its own art history as a resource and source. Now, any other questions? That was a long answer. Yeah.
Yep. There were figures there in a long panel, there were ground figures.
Now I'm going to have to go back again. In this one here, the two moieties. Yeah, exactly. Now, I could give a very long answer to that, but I won't. But, I mean, the thing to do is read my book, Ancestral Connections, or Becoming Art. Yolngu society is divided into moieties. If I was a Yolngu person, I would have started this lecture in a different way, with a discourse on kinship. But it would have... Yolngu would be able to do this, but because people would be respectful of them. But if I started talking for quarter of an hour about kinship, you'd get a bit fed up. But, you know, the society is divided into two moieties. People are either Dua moiety or Yiricha moiety. Dua moiety marry people, marry Yiricha moiety. They have different lands. They have different paintings. They have different spiritual identities. They have different afterworlds. But they all came out of the body of the same ancestral women in this story. Okay. Any other questions that anyone has, or shall we? Okay. Oh, I mean, not just women. I mean, it's characteristic of Aboriginal society that the dead are very much a living presence in all sorts of different kinds of contexts. Very often, in the landscape, in the presence of a particular smell or the wind blowing in a particular direction. And if you go out hunting with Yolngu, people will routinely go through the genealogy of people created associated with those places, who they think may be there, and ask them for their help in fishing and things like that. Yeah. So, I mean, people are present in the landscape, and in a way, that's why I'm saying that these paintings are a painting like this is very much a portrait of one or two or three people connected with that particular place, and people will see that identity. Yeah, definitely. Okay. Yeah.
Thanks.
Oh, yes. Yeah.